Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Martin, and this is Eastern Standard, a service of WEKU, produced with the support of Alltech, working together for a planet of plenty, and Dynamics Productions. In a March column, the New York Times' Paul Krugman asserted that, quote, "It's important to get real. There are powerful forces behind the relative and, in some cases, absolute economic decline of rural America, and the truth is that nobody knows how to reverse those forces," end quote. A link to the whole Krugman column can be found on eswEKU.com and our facts and information page. Just go to that and you'll find it there. The column has drawn a lot of response, and among those writing to take issue with Krugman's bleak perspective have been Mark and Julia Haggerty. Mark, an economic geographer at Headwaters Economics in Bozeman, Montana. Julia, an environmental historian in the geography department at Montana State University. Mark Haggerty joins us. Greetings, Mark.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on.
And Mark, I read with interest your column in the April 15th edition of the Daily Yonder. Tell us why you disagree with this assertion by Krugman and others that nobody knows, as he put it, nobody knows what to do about rural America's economic decline and marginalization.
I think one of the problems is there's an assumption behind the trends, and there are significant headwinds facing rural places, that those trends are somehow inherent to the economy and that they can't be changed or they can't be modified. And we disagree. A lot of what's happening in the economy and at the state level, at the national level, is driven by policies. And so when we think about it as a series of policy choices that we've made, that then allows us to think about different choices we could make that could affect the way that places are experiencing some of the trends that are going forward.
I want to explore the policy factor a little bit later, but first, you note many rural areas are in fact succeeding in innovative and creative ways, despite overwhelming odds. Tell us what you're seeing.
Well, we don't like this urban-rural dynamic very much. We think of places more in the characteristics that they have and potentially the vulnerabilities that they have. And so we notice that if you look at places that are non-metro, a lot of them are growing quite rapidly, and there are a bunch of reasons behind that. Some of them are connected to metropolitan areas, either because they are within commuting distance or they have airports that can get you to a city. And so those places, even though they may be small, are really looking more like metropolitan economies. They're able to participate in the high-tech, high-wage service sectors that are generating a lot of the new growth in the economy. Some places that aren't connected are still growing because they have recreation-based economies, national parks, natural amenities that are drawing people to those places and allowing new kinds of businesses to form. It's certainly true that natural resources are still important, and high commodity prices or a boom in oil or natural gas can lift a lot of isolated rural communities. It's really more of a challenge in our mind of how you manage those benefits, how you really capture the opportunities that you have. And one of the things that's pretty interesting to an economist, at least, the quality of the institutions in these communities, communities that have a vision, communities that have a culture of planning and of working together to get things done, they succeed above what their normal economic geography or their normal opportunities might suggest. And so really thinking about how these communities work together, how they network among their peers, turns out to be really important, and those types of places do well.
Okay, let's come back around to public policy. And you've noted that largely absent from this discussion are two fundamental public policy issues, public revenue and transition-oriented planning. Is that generally the case in rural areas across the country?
It is. And maybe a little background is to help us understand how we think about it.
Sure.
In the West, we had a huge expansion of coal mining and coal-fired power production, starting in the late 1960s and really accelerating through the 1980s. And in fact, a lot of the Western coal is responsible for some of the decline in the East. But that big shift was driven by a national policy. We had the Carter administration that was interested in domestic, reliable energy sources and promised that we would mine a billion tons of coal in the United States, and we accomplished that. We had a massive planning effort in the Western United States to build and reconfigure the electrical grid, to install the coal-fired power plants and the major surface mines. So there was a huge coordinated technical planning process that was supported by the region's universities. And we had a really responsive approach from the local leaders, largely driven by the Western Governors Association, to make sure that this worked for the communities where coal extraction was going to take place. So we had this really broad regional planning effort supported by national policy and led by local leaders that allowed all of this to happen. Since that time, we have had a huge wave of deregulation of the energy sector, and we've had a tax revolt across the West. And what it means now that these coal-fired power plants are beginning to close and the mines are losing their customers, that these communities don't have that kind of national support. They don't have the regional networks. And in some cases, after decades of coal production and supplying the nation with energy, they have very little to show for it. And so that lack of planning, that lack of coordination in the energy transition is leaving these communities to fend for themselves. And in some cases, they are not doing very well.
You have conducted research that shows how fiscal policy choices can worsen economic vulnerability and limit the range of choice in rural places. Tell us more about those findings.
Yeah, it's sometimes a difficult topic to talk about taxes, but we don't think about it as needing new revenue necessarily. It's changing the way that we manage the revenue and the wealth that we already have. And so communities can become overly dependent on a single source of revenue, especially rural communities that have a relatively specialized economy, because we're not allowed to budget more than an annual basis. And so what can happen when you have a boom in commodity prices is you increase spending because you have to spend all of your money that year. You're not allowed to save. And then you create risks for yourself during a bust when commodity prices fall or when activity slows. And so the autonomy of local governments to manage volatile revenue and to make long-term investments has been stripped. And that exposes these communities to annual boom and bust cycles. And over time, that can actually weaken the funding basis that supports the institutions that we find are really critical to resilience and long-term stability in these communities.
In Kentucky, in eastern Kentucky in particular, that's exemplified by what has been called a coal severance tax. And this was a tax on the value of coal extracted from the ground. As that extraction has declined precipitously, so have those revenues, which many of our communities relied on for local services and so forth. So I guess that would be our version of what you're talking about.
Yeah, and it's a story that's played out across the country and not only in coal. We've done a lot of work with Oregon communities that received substantial payments from timber harvests, largely on public lands. And while those timber harvests were high in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, local governments tended not to tax themselves because they didn't have to. They had this significant source of revenue, and so they used that revenue to fund their annual operating budgets. And had very low taxes at the local level. Oregon had a tax revolt in the 1990s that froze local property tax levies and froze assessments. So subsequently, when the federal revenue declined as harvest practices changed and budget austerity set in at the federal level, these communities no longer had that big source of revenue from outside, and their hands were tied behind their back. They couldn't manage their own budgets very well. And these communities are now facing significant fiscal stress, and they're talking about potentially bankruptcy and cutting services. And that is not what they need right now. They need to maintain libraries and good schools and public safety so that they can try to transform their economies. And so this trap of being dependent on a severance tax or a federal revenue sharing program is common across a lot of rural areas. And rather than an indication, as Krugman indicates, that these places don't have any opportunities and there are no solutions for them, for us, what it means is we've very badly mismanaged the opportunities that communities have, and we have artificially limited their choices. And so if we can reverse some of those trends, there's a tremendous amount of value and energy and opportunity happening in rural places. We just need a toolkit that allows us to realize that potential and move forward.
What has become the traditional response to the declining local revenues in the region here has been to offer pretty sizable tax breaks, tax incentives to industry, to corporations to set up operations in the area. You also mentioned federal assistance programs and how both of these can amplify the risk of fiscal crisis in rural communities. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, so one of the things that we've been looking at recently is new GDP data, so gross domestic product data at the county level. And what we expected to find was that most of the GDP is going to be created in cities where you see most of the new jobs being created and most of the new income concentrated. And in fact, that's not the case. Some of the counties that have the highest GDP per capita are rural counties. And so there's a mismatch between where value is being created in the economy and where employment opportunities exist and where revenue is being captured and reinvested into communities. And so the idea that we can save these places by providing tax breaks and trying to encourage companies to relocate just kind of deepens this mismatch between what is actually happening in these communities and the kind of returns that they get from it. So Montana, for example, had a fiscal budget crisis at the state level and convened an interim committee to look at it. And what we learned through that process is that our tax structure is decoupling more and more every year from the underlying economy. And the series of tax breaks, particularly business location relocation tax breaks that we provide, further exacerbates the difference between growth in the economy and revenue that can be used to support local institutions. And so we need to fix some of that. And we might need to rethink the way we think about what the value proposition is for rural communities. And it may not be encouraging companies to relocate through tax breaks.
So in your column, you have written that unwinding this fiscal dependency is maybe the key to unlocking the potential of rural America. What's on the other side of these policy barriers, things like the federal programs upon which these areas have become so dependent?
Yeah, fiscal policy is one of the keys. It's not the only key. But when we look down the road and try to think about what we can do for communities, we're focused on how we build wealth in these communities to create resilience over time. So if the current trap is that you have to spend your windfall revenue each year and you're not allowed to save for the future, reversing that would allow communities to manage their budgets over time, to save money during good years and invest it in activities and assets that will continue to generate wealth going forward. So one example, we've been working with these timber-dependent communities in the Pacific Northwest, and we now have a bill in the Senate, in the U.S. Senate, that would convert the annual revenue from timber harvests into an endowment. So we would create a permanent fund at the federal level that would begin to invest these revenues over time, that would create stable, predictable, and growing payments to communities that would allow them to rethink the way that they can plan for their budgets and plan for economic development going forward. And that will have ripple effects, we believe, in the kinds of opportunities and businesses that they're able to attract and retain.
We're talking with economic geographer Mark Haggerty, and we just have about a minute left, Mark. And I have a question that's kind of broad. This may be unfair to pack into a minute, but your general view of the future of rural America in this 21st century, what do you think?
I think we're going to see growth in rural America. If you look at what's happening in cities, most of the growth is concentrated there recently. But cities are having incredible challenges with housing affordability and inequality, and it is not necessarily a good policy to move people to cities in places where they can ill afford to make a living. And there is a trend that is emerging and we think is going to accelerate of people who grew up in rural places or people that are looking for a different kind of lifestyle that are eager to get out of cities. And if rural communities can offer them the kind of networks and institutions and relationships that they're looking for, there's a huge opportunity for rural communities to attract and retain businesses and families and reverse the trends that we've been seeing over the last decade or more.
Well, Mark, I think that's going to resonate with a lot of people we know here in central and eastern Kentucky. Mark Haggerty is an economic geographer at Headwaters Economics in Bozeman, Montana, and we thank you for joining us, Mark.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Coming up after the break, 5 years after its creation, has the first federal rural promise zone lived up to that title? We get an update from Sandy Curd of the Kentucky Highlands Investment Corporation. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
A planet of peril or plenty? We choose to believe in the latter. With the advent of new technologies, the adoption of improved management practices, and above all, the ingenuity inherent in the human spirit, a world of abundance could be ours. Alltech, working together for a planet of plenty.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers John Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com.
And now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
In 2014, President Obama designated 8 counties in southeastern Kentucky as the first federal rural promise zone in the USA. It's a partnership with Kentucky Highlands Investment Corporation with the aim of improving the overall quality of life in the region. Into the 5th year since it began, we're talking with Promise Zone Coordinator Sandy Kerr to get an update. Welcome, Sandy.
Oh, thank you, Tom.
And first, for everybody's benefit, what counties make up this Promise Zone?
Okay, we've got Bell, Clay, Harlan, Knox, Leslie, Letcher, Perry, and most of Whitley County.
And why these counties?
Well, first of all, these to become a promise zone, these were counties that had to be in distress, but there are plenty of those in eastern Kentucky. We took a look at those that were most devastated by the radical changes in the coal industry and had been hurt the most with that. Now, we were limited in that you could not identify a promise zone that was greater than 200,000 people, hence the reason why we have most of Whitley County. In order to not be eliminated with our application before we even were reviewed, we then pulled 2 census tracts out of Whitley County. So we drew a circle around 199,962 people trying to make ourselves the biggest that we can be. But that is not to say that folks like Knott County, Owsley Lee, McCrary, all of those counties equally deserving of a promise zone designation if it had been possible.
Is it possible that there might be some sort of help coming for them?
We don't see it with this. With the Promise Zone designation, it tends to be they had 3 rounds of designations. Nationally, there are 22 of us, 14 are urban, 4 are rural, and 4 are tribal. We don't see an expansion of that particular policy. I think the best example that we've seen most recently is Opportunity Zones, and many of those counties did receive census tracts labeled as Opportunity Zones.
So as I mentioned, we're into the 5th year
Yes.
of the Promise Zone designation. So what does this mean to those counties that are in the Promise Zone?
Well, essentially, what it has happened is, I should state, the Promise Zone did not come with a big bucket of money, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It came with a modest competitive advantage if you were going for certain federal funding streams. And with that, you got extra points. And so what we were able to do were to work with as many organizations as possible that were providing services or programming that fit one of those federal funding streams and work with them to try to secure that funding into our area. And so how does it look for each of the counties? Well, it varies. It depends on who was able to get in there, who was able to implement different programs into those particular areas. For the actual county itself, their experience with it could have just been able to be more competitive when they wanted to get two more police cars for the police force. Others, it's they're more competitive with a FEMA grant in order to support, say, like their volunteer fire department. So it just varies throughout the whole zone.
Have there been measurable improvements over these years?
Well, when you're looking at a place-based initiative like the Promise Zone, you're really challenged in how you're going to measure those. And for my own validation, I keep track of how many letters of support we wrote, how many of those have turned around and made, brought in and successfully been funded in our area. But we felt at Kentucky Highlands that it doesn't matter really how much you do of those, if you don't really impact the big census level data indicators, you're really not making a change. And I say this as we, because I'm part of Kentucky Highlands, but I hadn't been hired when these decisions were made. And they were the brilliance, I think, of that particular staff. They had the experience of doing the empowerment zone during the 1990s. And so they established a way to measure outcomes. And the way they did this is they have contracted with a third party data analyst out of Boston, Massachusetts. And in 2014, we looked at 77 census markers and established a baseline. And then every 2 years, we go back and look at those very same markers. The first report we've gotten now, it came out at the end of 2017, because, you know, there's that lag in data getting there and so forth. And we were I was almost afraid to get the report because I'm like, oh my goodness, there were still coal mines closing during this time, and things were really tough. And I can honestly tell you, we did not impact unemployment, we did not impact poverty, and so forth. But we did have a couple of bright spots that I think were directly related to the Promise Zone.
And what were those?
Well, one was a 42.9% increase in college and career readiness of our high schools. There are 17 high school districts in the Promise Zone, and they take some type of a test. And what they saw was this massive increase. And the reason I feel like it's part of the Promise Zone is because one of our most successful partners in the zone, Partners for Education at Berea College, has been hugely successful in bringing in Gear Up grants from the Department of Education, Promise Neighborhoods, full service grants, and they have really gotten in there into these school systems to provide those support services that undergird the student to allow them to be able to learn and succeed. I think that was a Promise Zone.
The Kentucky Highlands Investment Corporation website lists 10 goals.
Yes.
These are things like improving health and education, which you just talked about, more affordable, energy-efficient housing, expanded transportation access, revitalized downtowns, and more recreational arts and community engagement opportunities. And high among these goals is comprehensive and affordable access to high-speed broadband,
yes,
internet, and cell phone service, which kind of seems to be the holy grail in the region, the key to the future.
It is the key to the future.
And where does it stand?
Well, Kentucky Wired continues to be moving straight ahead. We've seen indicators that our ring for the Promise Zone, which is actually two rings that are going to incorporate those eight counties, we should see that in 2020. But that is the middle mile. And so we are obligated to figure out how we're going to be able to get that to every premise, every home and every business, because that's what it's going to take to be able to unleash the full power of this. Now, we have some communities that are well ahead of it. The Barbourville Utility Commission has long led the area in their implementation of good broadband and affordable broadband. They just created a gigabyte city, and you can get a gig of broadband for $75 a month there. But we need that everywhere and for everyone. And the reason this is so important, Tom, is because, well, it's a prime example through EKSEP. It's a workforce development group. They have a division called Teleworks USA. Teleworks has created these little hubs throughout Eastern Kentucky where they will take individuals and train them and get them certified in all the skill sets that remote employers are looking for. And so you come out and you've got all these certificates, and then they help you identify. They have a Rolodex of like 70 or 100 different national and international companies that hire people remotely. Companies like U-Haul, Xbox, Apple, Microsoft, and those types of things. And then they work for them to get those particular jobs. At the last SOAR conference we had in Eastern Kentucky last August, there were well over like 1,200 individuals working from home just since this came about. And that's with not the best broadband in the world, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So we know, well, I always remind folks, I'm like, when was the last time you went to a ribbon cutting in Eastern Kentucky for 1,000 jobs? And no one can remember ever, okay? You know, so that's 1,000 jobs of individuals that are living in their homes using what we have available. But the word is coming down, and the word that's coming down from these employers is you have to have two things. You have to have good download speeds, and you have to have good upload speeds.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the upload speeds where we're challenged. Coax cable has an upload speed of 3 megahertz. And places like Amazon and other employers are saying, guys, we need you to be able to get this data, to crunch this data, and to send it back to us, and you need to have 5. And you cannot get copper coax to go greater than 3. So we have to switch, and we have to get to the glass fiber. But once we get there, then we're good for years and years because it can expand. And so we can greatly increase our position in that area. But that's going to be the future because we're going to be able to do what we do best, stay home, take care of our folks, take care of our kids, enjoy our beautiful mountains, but still make a livable income working from home.
I can't tell you how many young adults in particular that I've heard from that have expressed an interest in living in the mountains, but they need that robust internet connection.
Well, and the other beauty of that, you know, one of the things that has challenged us in the Promise Zone is a mono economy that was based either on coal or on the services that support coal. When you go to an internet-based economy, you're immediately diversified because you will have some people working for U-Haul, which is transportation, other people doing medical coding, that's healthcare, maybe other people editing films for Steven Spielberg, and that's entertainment. Well, those particular industries do not have peaks and valleys all at the same time. And so we will then be able to take that economy, diversify it, and cause it some greater stability.
This Promise Zone was created under the Obama administration. Has federal support continued under the Trump administration?
It has continued, but it has also changed. And that is simply because that administration changed, the agencies changed. And so we had a new group of individuals that came forward to serve our country in those ways. We've had the 22 Promise Zones out there. We have had an ongoing biweekly conference call. We get together, we share our concerns and our desires, and we go forth to continue to educate on the values of this Promise Zone, what it accomplishes, how how budget neutral it is for the federal government, because not one new revenue stream was created to implement the Promise Zone. It was all existing. And we go up there to share those. And so we have most of ours, Promise Zones have committed that they're in it for the full thing. They signed a designation agreement and they're going to write it to the very end. I say that knowing, though, that the real solution for our Promise Zone is for us to come up with the answers, for us to implement the answers, and for us to make our economy and our life, our region, the best that it can be. And it's not going to come from D.C., and it's not going to come from, the state of Kentucky. It's up to us to do that.
Sandy Curd is the Kentucky Promise Zone Coordinator. Thanks, Sandy.
Oh, thank you, Tom.
Coming up after the break, has Kentucky arrived at an energy crossroads, one way leading to a future dominated by coal, the other taking us on a path to renewable energy sources? And the latest in our series, Humans of Central Appalachia. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
A planet of peril or plenty? We choose to believe in the latter. With the advent of new technologies, the adoption of improved management practices, and above all, the ingenuity inherent in the human spirit, a world of abundance could be ours. Alltech, working together for a planet of plenty.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com.
Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
The nation's renewable energy sector reached a big milestone earlier this spring. According to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, for the first time, the sector, which includes solar, water, wind, and geothermal steam, had slightly more energy-generating capacity than coal. Important to note, the FERC report measured capacity, not the actual amount of power generated. And renewable energy typically has a lower capacity utilization than other fuel sources. In other words, just because renewable power has the potential to generate this much electricity, it doesn't mean that it actually will, at least not yet. Renewable generation isn't expected to surpass coal on an annual basis for several years. But the early signs of transition are beginning to appear. Renewable energy sources generated more electricity than coal in April, according to a separate report published by the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis. In the meantime, at least two coal-fired power plants are expected to close in Kentucky this year, and another two are expected to close in 2020. With each retirement, residents will have to decide how they want to power the future. From member station WFPL in Louisville, Ryan Van Velzer takes a look at Kentucky's potential for transitioning to renewable energy.
Earlier this year, the Tennessee Valley Authority decided to shutter the remaining coal generators at the Paradise plant in western Kentucky against the advice of the president and Kentucky's governor. For Donald Trump and Matt Bevin, the aging generators at the Paradise coal-fired power plant are a symbol of prosperity, reliability, and employment. Bevin says coal is the only way man can produce the energy we need.
There literally isn't the ability to produce the electricity the world needs without coal. We're sitting on more coal and better versions of it than most of the rest of the world has. Why would we not take advantage of it? It's not just Kentucky.
But progress has always come at a cost. Here's folk singer John Prine back in 1971 singing about the price that the town of Paradise paid for that coal power.
Then the coal company came with the world's largest shovel, and they tortured the timber and stripped all the land. Well, they dug for their coal till the land was forsaken. Then they rode it all down as the progress of man.
Continuing to burn coal presents another larger risk. the greenhouse gases released from burning coal have contributed to a new milestone, the highest levels of carbon dioxide in all of human history. To reverse course and prevent the worst impacts of climate change, humanity needs to decrease carbon emissions to basically zero by 2050. How do we do that, and how long will it take? Solar researcher Thad Druffel has an answer.
One generation. So the next generation will be fully renewable here in Kentucky.
We're inside Druffel's laboratory at the University of Louisville's Kahn Center for Renewable Energy Research. In front of me is a slick, silver printing press that kind of looks like a mad science experiment.
All right, so we're running an experiment on this roll-to-roll coder, and the idea is to print the solar cells. So you can see over here, this is an experiment. That's the end of the experiment.
That's right. Druffel wants to print solar cells, and he's already demonstrated the technology will work. In fact, he just received a $1 million grant from the U.S. Department of Energy to scale up his technology using newspaper printing presses. He calculates that if one modern printing press ran 24 hours a day for a year, it would produce enough solar panels to power 10% of the world's energy needs.
So if you had 10 or so printing presses moving at the speed that these new presses are moving, you could basically power the whole world.
Now, Kentucky receives an average of about 4 to 6 hours of generating capacity for sunlight each day. That's not as much as some states out west, but Druffel says it will still be enough to provide much of the state's power.
Yeah, solar will work, and I see a future for both manufacturing the solar here, but also utilizing the solar energy in manufacturing facilities.
And solar isn't the state's only renewable resource. Kentucky has more navigable streams than any other state in the U.S. other than Alaska. President of Appalachian Hydro Associates David Brown Kinlock says at least 50 existing dams in Kentucky could be repurposed to generate electricity.
If you've been living in Kentuckiana, you know from all the rain we've been getting why hydro is such a potential resource around here.
And here's a cool thing. If you use, say, solar energy to pump water uphill during the day, it can be stored and used to generate hydroelectricity at night when the sun isn't shining.
It's essentially a giant battery. That's right.
Brown Kinlock also thinks there's potential for wind energy in Kentucky.
Well, that's all low to the ground. And as you know, Kentucky is full of trees. And until you get above the tree line, you don't sense the real wind potential.
Now, not all renewable energy advocates agree with Brown Kinlock about wind potential in Kentucky. But at the Kahn Center, Director Mahendra Sankara says there are other options as well. He says that natural gas and biomass may continue to play a role as a bridge fuel until we reach that net zero carbon future.
Some of these units, assets, you can retrofit or you can actually come up with a carbon capture technology and converting it into some other use for those carbon that you capture.
The best science we have says that we have to transform energy production, not just in Kentucky, but all across the world. Sankara stresses that Kentucky's future prosperity and economic development hinges on the adoption of renewable energy technologies. I'm Ryan Van Velzer in Louisville.
We were in Irvine recently and got into a lively conversation with folks there about the Kentucky Rail Heritage Center, an economic development project coming together in the neighboring town of Ravenna. There's a lot of excitement over what it could mean to Estill County, and that excitement's about to get a big boost. A restored Chesapeake and Ohio steam locomotive, number 2716, one of the largest locomotives to ever run on the line between Louisville and Ashland, leaves the Kentucky Railway Museum in New Haven next month for a journey to its new home in Ravenna, its first appearance in the region in over 60 years. And along the way, on July 27th, that's a Saturday, this 400-ton engine is making a day-long stop in Midway to serve as the centerpiece for Midway Heritage Day. The tracks run right through Midway's business district. The restoration of 2716 is a collaboration between CSX Transportation and R.J. Corman Railroad Group. We have another in our ongoing series, Humans of Central Appalachia, photographer Malcolm Wilson's collection of Appalachian voices sharing life in the mountains as they know it and live it. Allow me to introduce
Ronnie Walker.
A lifelong resident of Harlan, Ronnie worked for 28 years at the Pineville Hospital as a licensed practical nurse, retiring in 2014.
I've been busy ever since, though.
And we'll get into what's keeping Ronnie Walker busy in just a moment, but first, some history.
I grew up in a predominantly black neighborhood, and so they say it takes a village. Well, truly, it was like that. We had our boundaries, but we also knew that anyone in that neighborhood had the authority to tell us what we could and couldn't do.
This was in the early, racially segregated 60s.
I come up in a time where you had the black waiting rooms, where you had to sit in the back of the bus. When they decided to build another pool, the blacks got the pool on Elm Street, which was actually bigger than the pool that they built, replaced it. So you had black kids swimming over on Elm Street, and then the white kids. And then we had white people there that we played with, but, you know. So it wasn't so out there, but it was here. We were allowed to go in the restaurants, but we couldn't sit down. We could order our food, but we couldn't sit down. You take it out somewhere. But it was so routine that, you know, you just never thought about it. You just said, this is the way it is.
Until it no longer was. Ronnie had been attending Rosenwald High School.
It was the black school here in town.
When integration came to Harlan.
We started out at Rosenwald in the ninth grade for 1 week, and then they said, you got to go to this other school. And so they just dropped us down there. We didn't know anybody. We didn't know the school. We didn't know anything.
And it was scary.
Because we didn't get to go to tour of the school. We didn't know where our homerooms were, our teachers, or anything like that.
It was a culture shock.
Because I went from a school that discipline was one of the number one things to a school that sometimes anything goes. So it was, like, strange because some of the things we saw the other kids do, we were like, we would not have been allowed to do that. One of my instructors, I remember her saying, she says, integration is good. She said, but it's maybe going to ruin the black kids. And I asked her why, and she said, because I've never seen any more malleable children than came from down here. And so, and as years went by, I saw what it did do because I thought, well, if they can do that, I can do that. And so some of the kids that came up after me, they sort of forgot what they were taught.
So what is keeping Ronnie Walker busy these days? Well, for one thing, Harlan's Higher Ground Theater.
I like the challenge of doing something that I've never done before. And I'm not one of those that always steps outside the comfort zone, but with Higher Ground, I'm able to do a lot of things like if I do public speaking, I get really, really nervous. But when I'm on stage, I don't get nervous because I'm someone else.
And life in the mountains?
I love these mountains, and I love the people here.
Ronnie Walker of Harlan, Kentucky, the latest voice in our series, Humans of Central Appalachia. You'll find this feature and a photo of Mr. Walker on our website, esweku.com. That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced by WEKU in the Lexington studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of Alltech, working together for a planet of plenty. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on the WEKU mobile app or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher. We'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu or call and leave voicemail at 859-622-WEKU. That's 622-9358. We might include your thoughts in a forthcoming edition, if that's okay. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.